The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, all of a sudden you blink and you're at the quarterway mark of the season. It's absolutely flown by, hasn't it?
It has absolutely sailed by, and now I think we're in a position where we can sort of, this table is sort of sorting itself out. We can see who are the contenders for ACL, who are going to go relegated. Gamba is a bit of an annoying one at four games, but yeah, it's settled down very nicely. It's been a very exciting start to the season.
Most definitely. So yeah, some teams have played as many as 10 games at the moment, but Gumba only four, of course. And we're here to review match day 9, which is just about the quarterway mark of the season. So with that in mind, and after we asked our patrons for some questions for this week's episode, we might lead off this week, Sam, with one from Johnny Nickel, and it's I guess it's a timely one as we reach this part of the season, or even though Johnny himself says it's still early days. So for you, Sam, which player and a manager have impressed you most so far? And we'll come on to the other part of Johnny's after you give your first answer, if you like.
Yeah, well, there are plenty of very good performers so far, so I don't want to necessarily go with the regular ones that we always mention, like your Inagakis and your Tanakas, who I think are probably the best two players so far. But one in an area that I've never praised at all, I don't think, on this podcast. I'm going to go for Ryoho Kikuchi, the Vissel Kobe centre-back, which might be a curveball, but I think he has been absolutely fantastic so far this season. He barely played, really, last year, but they've settled into this 4-4-2. Vermaelen's not played every game, but Kikuchi has been there. He has been an absolute rock. His positioning is superb. He heads balls away. He's just very commanding as well for a 24-year-old who's had to deal with a few different partners. And at the other end, I mean, he scored some absolute bullet headers. The one against Kawasaki, particularly good. But yeah, he's come on a leaps and bounds, and Kobe have been a lot more resilient this season. And I think he is a very big part of the reason why.
All right, well, before you give maybe a manager you had in mind, Sam, I guess there's one pretty obvious candidate we might both end up springing for. I won't go too adventurous. I'll plump for the Nagoya Grampus defence as a unit. Conceding just at one goal in 9 games is absolutely phenomenal. We wondered what they could do to top last season's record-setting clean sheet total, of course, when they kept clean sheets in exactly half of their league games. Well, they have 8 out of 9 so far to start this season, which is frankly remarkable. And sorry, Johnny, it's a bit of a cop out to pick 5 players, but yeah, I'm going to go for the Nagoya backline.
Yeah, very good shout. I mean, yeah, you can't argue with that. And they've managed to do it while rotating a little bit in and out of that. It's been, yeah, pretty incredible. From what I've seen, they've conceded about 2 chances that maybe could have resulted in goals besides their own goal. So, yeah, incredible performance from Nagoya.
And so what about a coach then?
Yeah, this is it's not really the manager, actually, but I'm going to go with Takeshi Komoto at Tokushima Vortis, given he's had to deal with this team with the manager on Zoom or in quarantine or whatnot. And Tokushima, given how poor they were last time they were in the league, to be 10th, they're playing very good football. They're not conceding too many goals, not scoring enough, maybe, but this brand that they're playing, they've shown no fear. And I've been really impressed with them. And for him to come in, it's such a unique and difficult situation. I think he deserves a lot of credit. I mean, yeah, what about you, if you plump for?
Well, I should say that's an absolutely terrific shout. And your points are very well made there. I was just going to go for Kim Myung Wee at Tosu for what he's done with them. We've talked about it, them quite a lot already in this young season, how impressive they've been. And Kim has worked wonders. We saw the seeds being sown towards the end of last season, of course, when they made themselves hard to beat. And this year they have well and truly kicked on, and fourth on merit after 9 match days of this season. And Kim deserves an awful lot of credit for that. So that's a terrific couple of shouts I would say there. And just one more point on Tokushima before we move on to the second half of Johnny's question. We've mentioned it a lot. Their horrible performance in 2014, the first time they're up in J1. After this week, they now only need one more more win, i.e. three more points to match their points haul from all of the 2014 season. So, yeah, it's just been an absolutely terrific start to the season for them in very trying circumstances, as you say, with Danny Poyatos still, not allowed to take officially take charge on the touchline. So, absolutely terrific there. So, Johnny's part two of Johnny's question, Sam, was which winter signing do you think has made the most immediate impact through nine rounds of the season so far?
Yeah, this is a fairly difficult one, I thought, because most of them haven't actually played yet and they're still waiting to come into the league. But I'm going to go pretty safe. I'm going to go with Joao Schmidt. I think the way he's come into that midfield at Kawasaki, because Morita is a big loss and is playing very well in Portugal. But for Schmidt to come in, I think he started almost every game. I might have not played in one. And just he plays at that base of the midfield. He links defence and attack superbly. I mean, involved will go on to the Tokyo game, but he was involved in a lot of the through balls coming through there, so he's got that presence to go forward, but also he covers really well, and as a attacking force from a corner as well, they've been really targeting him. So I just think his all-round game has been really good, considering that he didn't play too much for Nagoya, but he's just settled in very nicely, and he's kept Kawasaki ticking along.
Yeah, well, it was bound to happen. I thought it might happen when we were talking about our manager of the season so far. But, yeah, I was going to go for Schmidt as well. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you could just about put anybody into this Kawasaki machine and it would just tick on as it had did pretty much all of last season. But, yeah, there's no question that Schmidt has been an excellent fit. And, they haven't missed a beat as a unit, even though, as you say, Morita is doing so well in Portugal and was such an important part of their team last year. So, Johnny, you got some different answers in the first half of your questions, but we're both going for Joao Schmidt as our most impressive winter signing so far. If listeners, if you're wondering where our Match Day 8 review might be, if you're not a patron of the podcast, of course, well, Sam and I did a bonus podcast for our patrons last midweek's round. So we're going to plow straight ahead and pick up with the action from the weekend's Match Day 9. And we'll begin actually, Sam, with another question from Patreon, because Khalil Kayal was wondering about when fan chanting will be allowed back into the stadiums. And this is kind of it's topical, because the biggest crowd of the season so far in the Kanto area, and it might even be across all of the J League, was at Ajinomoto Stadium on Sunday for the Tamagawa Classico. There were over 17,600 in, and obviously the atmosphere is not quite J League esque, even though the number was so big, Sam. But could you notice on the when you were watching a slight, I don't know, volume level increase with that many more punters in, or was it, I don't know, much of a muchness?
I mean, there was a little bit. I mean, it's the worst, bar the Nissan Stadium, probably the worst stadium to kind of feel that extra noise, because it's just so vast. So even 17,000 in there, it's not a major increase, but it was good to have a few more extra in there. There was a great noise. I know Kawasaki, I think, came out after the game and just said how much it helped them to have the extra fans in there, because, everyone ups their games when they play in front of more fans. So the sooner we can get more and more into the buildings, I think the quality and intensity of games will only increase. So, yeah, I think it did help a little bit, but it would be maybe a little bit more noticeable at other grounds.
Yes, indeed, and I should say the Frontale supporters are doing quite a good job with their rhythmic clapping, so they were doing their best to replicate some of their chants by with their clapping. So that was that added to the atmosphere. So Khalil's question in full was when will fan chanting be allowed back into the stadiums? As I mentioned earlier, so I took this to Dan Olowitz, who I was certain would know the answer, or would be the person best to ask, who was most likely to know. Dan was very gracious and got straight back to me with his answer. Dan says, when the medical experts advising the league say that chanting can be allowed, That's the response that Dan himself got from the league when he asked what the circumstances would be for restoring active support. Dan says basically he doubts that will be before the start of the 2022 season. They're also looking at the state of infections and the vaccine rollout. So it'll be a combination of things, Khalil. But it sounds like the full-blooded J-League stadium experience will unfortunately not be possible. I don't know if that's the right word, but yeah, likely at least in 2021. But yeah, we hope. Obviously, we hope the situation improves and normality returns, and we can get back to what we know and love about the J League in terms of the full experience at the start of the 2022 season. Fingers crossed. Thanks to Johnny and Khalil for your questions so far. There are more to come from our patrons, Sam, but yeah, let's get on to matters on the pitch. And the leaders, Kawasaki, obviously continue to roll on. It was a difficult watch for me, as I'm sure you can understand, Sam, on Sunday when FC Tokyo hosted Frontale. The last three Ajinomoto Stadium Classicos had all been won by Frontale by an aggregate of 9-0, so I was fearing the worst at kickoff, and I was fearing a cricket score when Kawasaki went 2-0 up inside 20 minutes, and indeed Kaoru Mitoma had the ball in the net for a third time for Frontale a couple of minutes after that, only for his goal to be disallowed for offside. Sam, this was just, partly self-inflicted from FC Tokyo, but it was a perfect indication of Frontale's ruthlessness at pouncing on Tokyo mistakes and making them pay.
They're not a team you want to be making mistakes against, and I think maybe even for all four goals there were bits that Tokyo didn't do very well. And yeah, you can't just give, like the first one, Okazaki just chips it into no man's land, into Zhao Schmidt, and then it is very quickly that they get possession, they go forward, 1-2 passes into Iyanaga, and it's a terrific finish. I mean, yeah, diving header sort of from him. It's not necessarily the goal you expect from Iyanaga, but he's putting everything away so far this season. And yeah, the second goal, again, it was that play right into Damião, he's turning provider in this game, just straight out to Iyanaga, and a glorious finish, the second goal. But again, it was just a poor pass from Aoki, just straight out. And I mean, when Kawasaki, they're going to boss every game, and they don't need a helping hand, and Tokyo just gave them to it, and they had a two-goal head start, and not many teams are coming back from that against Frontale.
No, that is for definite. And yes, I mean, as I say, Mitoma had the ball in the net. I think it was the 23rd minute. That was a pretty clear offside on the first replay, but it did take the VAR quite a while to let the referee know that the goal should be disallowed. So obviously, Frontale were just sweeping everything before them and just, as we say, pouncing on every Tokyo slip-up. Okazaki at fault for the first on a couple of occasions. As Sam says, poor ball out of defence, but then he was slow moving up to make the defensive line, and he was playing Iyanaga on as the Tokyo appealed for offside. But yes, Okazaki was late getting up, and then the Aoki's ball into no man's land for the second. But Iyanaga absolutely terrific, and nonchalant as you like, and not even really bothering to celebrate, just like, you know, that's what Frontale expect to do in games like this against an opponent like that. And you can't fault them for their confidence. I'm not going to say arrogance, but it could have been anything. Tokyo did manage to get a foothold in the game, and that largely centered around the halftime substitution of Shuto Abe off and Adailton on. I don't know, Sam. In general play, I thought Tokyo were able to kind of, as you say, Frontale still bossed the game. But for example, Tokyo were able to limit Miki Yamane's involvement. I mean, they played four, basically Tokyo played four centre mids, didn't they? So they were they were kind of intent on stopping Frontale attacking down the wings. Of course, that meant when they made mistakes in the centre of the pitch, Frontale were able to just play through them. But I don't know, it was slightly interesting the way that Kenta Hasegawa set Tokyo up, but I think there are question marks over some players who are not involved at this stage, and well, the main one, I might as well address it now, the fact that Leandro, the Tokyo Leandro, appears to be missing in action, and there are rumours that it's a disciplinary problem.
The whole selection in this game was very interesting because you also went in with Watanabe out suspended. Umari, we think, is injured. Hotaka Nakamura is not there. And yeah, and Leandro, I'm not really sure what's going on with him because he has. It's not like he's completely out of it because every now and then he appears on the bench. So I'm not really sure what's going on. As is pretty usual with J-League teams, they don't come out and tell you anything. So nobody really knows what's going on with him. And he seems quite frustrated if you go by social media posts and whatnot. But, I mean, it's all speculation at the moment because there is no reason. If he's fit, Leandro should start every game. He's been fantastic for Tokyo since signing from Kashima. So it is a very weird situation. And yeah, with the rest of the team, you mentioned they've four centre midfielders. I don't know if that was in response to having to put Morishige back into the back line because Omari and Watanabe are out. And there's no real trust, I don't think, in Aoki to play in that midfield role. And you kind of need all the bodies you can get there. But by doing that, yeah, you've got those players and then you've got to try and... Kawasaki, you've got so many options. So if you are stopping the wide attacks, then you leave the hole in the middle and vice versa. And I think... But generally, I agree with you. I thought they played quite well first half. In forgetting the individual errors, it was fairly tight and Kawasaki weren't necessarily creating too much just out of their own individual brilliance. There was the one moment, I think, where Mitoma picked it up and ran past about three or four players. And I just really felt for Takumi Nakamura having to face up to Mitoma in this game. But yeah, they were quite limited, but Tokyo, I think, maybe restricted themselves going forward with the change because you've scored a lot of goals this season playing the 4-3-3 with Adalton and Tagawa wide of Diego. So I think you were kind of limited going forward in that way. And I think the idea was to try and just keep it as tight as possible. But yeah, with the two goals, that game plan went out the window. So he was forced into this change. Adalton, I think, was the right person to come on. I'd never take Shuto Abe off out of those four options in the centre of midfield. But yeah, Adalton did come on and he did look pretty impressive. I think it's probably been his best season in the J-League with Jubilo and Tokyo. So, yeah, he came on, made a difference, and Tokyo looked a little bit more attacking and a little bit more threatening in the second half.
Yes, indeed. And, yeah, so Adalton gave Tokyo their lifeline just before the hour when he fired in first time after Kensuke Nagai's cutback rolled across the box. And then, well, yeah, one of the major talking points of the weekend, at least from an FC Tokyo fan perspective, centred around, well, ultimately, Kawasaki's third goal. But whether the Kawasaki goalkeeper, Kenta Tano, had taken the ball outside the box before, basically, yeah, he started the attack that led to Mitoma scoring Frontale's third goal. So there were howls from behind the goal, Sam. It was one of those where the keeper comes out to the side of his box to claim a ball over the top. It was replays were inconclusive on the DAZN telecast. I'm not sure exactly what sort of replays from that angle would be available to the VAR, and indeed whether that is even VARable. Sam, I know whether the ball has gone out of play is able to be reviewed if a goal is scored, I believe, but whether in general play VAR is able to check. Whether the keeper's handled outside the box or not, I actually don't know, and whether you can shed any light on that if you know yourself. Also, if it had been VAR'd and Tano was found to have taken the ball outside the box, would he... I don't know, he's not exactly denying a goal-scoring opportunity there. Would that have been a red card or a yellow card or just a free kick? What do you know about the situation, whether you thought he actually did take the ball outside the box?
Yeah, we've got a lot to unpick here. Yeah. First, if we're just taking that incident in isolation, it can't be reviewed because it's not a red card. As you said, there's no denying of a goal-scoring opportunity. There'd be a free kick. I'm not even sure there'd be a yellow, really, because, I mean, what is it doing? It's not doing anything, really. There's no one attacking him. He's not stopping anything. So I think it would have been a free kick, but it can't be reviewed in any case. It's not a red card, so they've got no choice in that. Whether they could have reviewed it for, because it led to the goal kind of eventually, because I think it was about 8 or 9 passes between the goalkeeper and Mitoma finally scoring. So we have seen it go back, but usually it's been 2 or 3 passes at most before the goal. So I'm really not sure on how far they're allowed to go back, because you can argue that the goalkeeper having it leads to the goal. But in any case, it's so inconclusive from the replays. I think from what I've seen, I'd say he's on the line, and the line is the area. If it's same with a penalty, same with crossing the line for a goal. He has to have all the ball out of the box. And I don't think anyone looking at what replays we've been shown can say that it was definitely outside the box. And with the VAR, the way they set the cameras up, I can't imagine they've set a camera up on that line. Because it's so rare that anything happens in that part of it. I don't think so. And I think we would have seen it on the VR reviews when he went, when we saw the camera, sorry. But yeah, so and we don't know if it's been reviewed either, because the VAR doesn't have to show that every time they check everything in the background. So they may well have looked at this and just not been shown on TV. So it's so hard to deal with. But I just think from what I've seen, there's no clear and obvious error from the referee, so I just think that goal is always going to stand. So yeah, and looking at it, I think it's still in the area, so I think the correct decision was made.
Yeah, I don't think it's yeah, definitely out. So it was one of those where I'm pretty sure Tanner's part of his body is outside the box while he's controlling the ball, but yeah, he looks like he's holding the ball over the line. So it's one of those, and yeah, as you say, just unfortunate for Tokyo supporters. And I guess if I was sitting behind the goal, I would still be pulling my hair out about it. But so you mentioned 8 or 9 passes leading up to Mitoma putting the ball in the net. Unfortunately for Takumi Nakamura, as you mentioned, he had a bit of a nightmare coming up against Mitoma. It was his poor touch and then slip that actually let Mitoma in for his finish in the 61st minute. It was a rough day for the young Tokyo right back, one that he'll certainly learn from, I hope. And, he'll be glad he doesn't have to come up against a player the quality of Mitoma each and every week. So that was Frontale's 2-goal cushion re-established just after Tokyo had got their lifeline. Then with 15 minutes left, Shogo Taniguchi headed a free kick back across goal, and Leandro Damião swept home to make it 4-1. There was some late gloss added to the scoreline from a Tokyo perspective, but merely a consolation as Takuya Uchida headed in across from a fellow substitute Yojiro Takahagi with 6 minutes left for Uchida's first J1 goal. But Frontale continue to boss this fixture, and they remain 5 points clear at the top of the table. And Nagoya winning this weekend adds, I guess, keeps things interesting for the time being, Sam. But should we come on to one of Grum Frecce's questions for this week's episode? He did ask one on each of Frontale and Grampus, so I guess we'll use those to bridge these two games, if you like. Grum Frecce on Frontale: if the champions manage to win both games against Grampus in May, this will pretty much seal the deal for them. Will they take their foot off the gas and focus on winning the ACL, or will they just keep on winning every game, including the ACL?
I can say it's somewhere between the two, but I think Kawasaki will just keep ploughing on because they've got records that they're going for. I mean, they're breaking records last season. They've started this season even better than last year, and I just think they will keep on going with the ACL. will be a slightly annoying distraction, but they have the squad and the ability to rotate around and still have very good players out on the pitch that can go out and you'd expect, they go into every game expecting to win, and I think they will win the vast majority of them. So, yeah, I've got no words of encouragement for the rest of the league because I don't think Kawasaki is slowing down anytime soon.
Well, yeah, it's hard to see, isn't it? Yeah, and we should say that, last week we had Johnny Nicol on, of course, and we were mentioning that there'd been some tweaks made to the J1 fixture list related to the ACL teams and that competition being moved around yet again. And I'm not sure if we mentioned, I don't think we did, that we had we'd obviously teased that the first meeting of the season between Nagoya and Kawasaki was coming in match day 12. Well, little did we know, Sam, that the JE League was going to move the return fixture from the second half of the season into the same week. So the top two, as they are now, are actually going to play twice in a week, aren't they, in May? So I don't know if as Granfrecce says, if Frontale managed to win both of those games, the rest of the season will probably feel very anticlimactic. But I guess on the flip side, the Grampus have a perfect opportunity to flip this season on its head.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a very positive way of looking at it, and that's what Grampus will be thinking. And I mean, they're not conceding goals, so we might just get 2-0 in the week. But I don't like it. When you look at that, so far they've been the best two teams in the league. You want these games to be individual. You want them to feel important, and to have them so close together, where teams are probably not going to play their strongest team in both of them because you're going to have to rotate around a little bit. I think it detracts a little bit from it. You want this another one a bit later on. I know they've been quite hamstrung by the AFC not getting their act together, but yeah, someone should have just had a look at this and thought, push the Tokyo one, not the Tokyo, push this Kawasaki Nagoya game later on into the season. Just, there's got to be another space for it. So yeah, it's slightly disappointing, but yeah, it becomes a pivotal week because the league's only hope is Nagoya win both games, and yeah, it's all over almost if Kawasaki win both.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, isn't it? After 9 rounds, we're obviously we've got a 20 team J1 for the first time ever. But basically, if you remove the top two, we're just going to fight it for the title amongst themselves. We have an 18 team race for third, so we kind of still have an 18 team J1. It's just that the rest of them are playing for third spot. But anyway, well, yeah, still obviously so many games, but the points differences are already quite stark, aren't they, Sam? It's 5 points from first to second, and obviously 5 from a second to third after Nagoya won on Sunday, but Kobe were held to a draw by Shimizu. So that's a 5-point gap as well. Now we'll move on to Grampus and their trip to Oita on Sunday next. And obviously Grampus had struggled for goals in the previous week, 2-0 draws in a row, but they got back on track. Away at Trinita, and it was unfortunately for Oita and their keeper Shun Takagi, the opener was clearly avoidable. Despite, it must be said, an absolutely brilliant piece of skill by Mateus in the build-up.
Yeah, I mean, Nagoya picked the right team if they were after some goals, because, I mean, this was put on a plate for Yamasaki. Mateus, as you say, fantastic down the left-hand side. Just, terrific skill. The cross isn't very good. It's straight to Takagi. There is no reason for him to drop that. He's under no real pressure, but drop it he does. Not only just drop it, he drops it right on the toe of Yamasaki, who cannot miss. I mean, he's so delighted for that because, he's not going to get many goals this season, but, awful from Oita. And the second goal, again, Oita just a little helping hand, bit of brilliance from Mateus. The free kick is a really good delivery, but Saka absolutely meets this bullet header into his own net. So yeah, Oita really helping out Nagoya, who needed it from the way they've been performing the last two games.
Yes, indeed. Yamasaki's goal in the 33rd minute after a howler from Takagi, and then as Sam says, the Keisuke Saka own goal a minute before half time, and the finishing touches were put on the 3-0 win by a certain Yoichiro Kakitani, who netted his first Grampus goal in the 92nd minute with a first-time finish from Shunpei Naruse's cross. Grampus was the topic of another question from Graham Freche, and I think you're probably going to go along with his question here, Sam. It's on Yoichiro Kakitani. Can we all agree that, despite his goal, Kakitani is exactly as expected, a total useless acquisition? He hasn't produced one memorable, helpful thing in every game he played so far. I just don't see any value in giving him minutes. Almost the same goes for Manabu Saito, but he has not been as bad as Kakitani. And, you've hardly been complimentary about Kakitani in the early days of this season, Sam.
No, he's not very good. He plays there and he just doesn't offer anything in terms of build up. If anything, he makes them actively worse, because if the ball goes into him, he will lose it. And this goal, I mean, it's fairly well taken, but it's good work from Naruse down the side. But I mean, it's a free effort from about 10 yards, and so you would expect him to score. But it's just the build up really that's not been. He's just just useless. I just don't see it. I don't see what he brings to them. And when you've got players, the quality of Gabriel Xavier, who plays in that same position, and you've got Kakitani playing ahead of him, it just baffles me. And Hiroyuki Abe's there as well. Maida, I'd have ahead of him. And to have that, to have him there, I really don't understand it. I didn't understand the signing at the time. I don't understand why he's continued to play. But thankfully, he was dropped for this game. They were slightly better, but not really. They were just helped by Oita. So, just stop playing him, please.
fair enough. You call it as you see it, Sam, so that's okay. Rightio, we'll move.
He wasn't due to be a guest anytime soon, was he?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe so. And, Graham Frecci's not finished there. There's more questions from him to come later on in the episode, and we'll get to those as we move through the rest of the games. We can probably get through the next game fairly quickly, Sam. It's Kobe 1, Shimizu 1. I teased it earlier. One of the misses of the season, though, in this game came at very early doors when Shimizu's Yuito Suzuki hit the post from a tight angle to give him a little bit of an out, but he's got to be finishing into an empty net after the Kobe keeper Daiya Maekawa came out to clear a mishit back header about 50 yards from goal, and Suzuki nipped the ball away from him. Suzuki didn't have the ball under control when he took it past Maekawa, so the ball did roll well and truly out of his control. But he had an empty net to aim at from an angle. But thankfully for Maekawa and the Kobe defence, the ball came back off the post. One of those that Suzuki will be having nightmares about for years to come, I reckon, Sam.
Yeah, it's one of those where he goes viral and I see J-League stuff coming up, and it's always bad. It's always when it's the worst of the J-League. So, I've had this cycling around. I mean, I feel for him because he's got a score. I mean, he's got time as well. I think he could even have a touch and then put it and then roll it in. But he's off balance. He kind of panics, I think, when he gets in the position. Falls over and hits the post. And you've got to take advantage of that because it's the first occasion, really, of old school Vissel Kobe with the goalkeeper 40 yards from goal, the defence completely messing it up. But they've just got to take that. And poor Suzuki. I mean, he won't get a better chance to score a J-League goal.
No, absolutely. And then, shortly before half-time, the Espol striker Thiago Santana curled a free kick against the post. Then, just past the hour, Thiago cut inside and drew a save from Maekawa from inside the D. But it was Shimizu. They'd had the better of the chances, and they finally took the lead in the 74th minute. Again, Thiago was involved. His cross from the left was met by El Senyo. Somebody you'd mentioned in recent times had not been getting much game time, Sam, so it was good to see him involved, and he volleyed back across Maekawa to give S-Pulse the lead. But then late on, there was late drama. There tends to be in the Kobe games, doesn't there, Sam? Ryo Hatsuse crossed from the left, and Kyogo Furuhashi fired in from inside the six-yard box in the 88th minute. For him, it's goals in four straight games now, and after equalising so late, Kobe could have won it, but a leaping Shuichi Gonda tipped over Yuta Gorke's header in stoppage time. So, S-Pulse, obviously, they will be frustrated not to have seen this one out, but late drama. They could have left with nothing were it not for for Gonda's spectacular save.
Yeah, I have to give a lot of credit first to Gonda. What a save. I mean, it's headed into the turf. It's so difficult for him to react to that one, and he gets a very strong hand to it. And he saves Shimizu because for, well, I say about 80 minutes, Shimizu were clearly the better team. This was the worst performance I've seen from Kobe all season, and Shimizu should have scored a few more. I thought Thiago Santana played very, very well. It's probably his best performance since coming in. He was involved in everything, either on the end of it or as he was setting up the goal with a delicious crossover to El Sino. But Kobe, I have to give them a lot of credit because this season, compared to every other season, they just have this resiliency. Every other season, I think this would have been an easy victory for Shimizu, the way that Kobe were playing. But for them to get back into it, to get, obviously get the equaliser through Furuhashi, who's just been clinical so far playing up front. I mean, he's ousted Douglas quite clearly from this position. He's just made it his own. And they should have scored. I think Gorke, it doesn't necessarily connect as well as he would have liked with the header heading it down. But for them to have almost won a game that they played so poorly in is testament to kind of their newfound mentality this season. And hopefully for Kobe supporters, this continues and they can get back to the ACL places, which is where they should be.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, let's move on to the next game and the early season surprise packets. Sagan Tosu kept the good times rolling. Well, they got back to winning ways with a 3-0 home win over Yokohama FC on Sunday. I mentioned in the Patreon-only podcast late last week that, yeah, at the start of the season, we would have expected this to be a relegation dogfight six-pointer, but instead these teams are at opposite ends of the table now, and, Tosu flying high, moving back up to fourth with this win, taking advantage of slip-ups by Cerezo Osaka and Hiroshima, not to mention FC Tokyo. Another fantastic performance from Tosu, and a brace for Keita Yamashita, who's now up to 5 J1 goals this season. He got the opener in the 19th minute when he volleyed in from 6 yards. Yokohama FC failed to clear a corner. Eduardo hooked the ball back in, and Yamashita pounced. It was Akiya Sento who had won that corner with a strike from 25 yards that was tipped over by Yuta Minami. Yokohama FC, they did have the odd chance here and there. In the 32nd minute, Keijiro Ogawa surged forward from halfway and let fly from 25 yards. Park Il-gyu made a superb save to tip his low drive past the post. But Fuchi Honda, keep it going, Fuchi. Your rookie cards keep going up in value, and yeah, I'm absolutely loving it. He fired in a rasper from 25 yards at 5 minutes into the second half. Absolutely brilliant strike. Then Yamashita finished off his brace with a neat finish from a Hwang Seok Ho through ball with 20 minutes to go. Park was busy again with the 15 minutes to go and saved well from Rio Germain's header. But, Tosu, clinical, Sam. And it was good to see, obviously, for Yokohama FC, another difficult result, but under their new coach. But, Tosu keeping the good times rolling.
Yeah, the new manager bounce is not going to work at Yokohama FC. Yeah. I mean, they're beyond that. But yeah, Tosu back to winning ways. I was really happy to see Yamashita back into the side, who'd been dropped for no real reason for the last two games, and they were clearly worse without him. And yeah, he comes in and he shows, yeah, real clinical striker's edge. The two finishes are really good, just good anticipation. With the first one, Eduardo keeping the ball alive. Yamashita was alive himself and got the goal. Honda's strike is, yeah, really good, right into the top corner. I mean, the defending is not there from Yokohama, who just allow him to just surge through kind of unchallenged. But, yeah, he still has to take the shot on and find the top corner, and he did that really well. And, yeah, the other goal, Hwang Seok Ho is playing through balls in, which, I mean, if he's getting it through your defence, you're in trouble. But he got it through to Yamashita. Yeah, really good finish. And just Yokohama, just they had a few moments where they had chances and were denied by good saves, but they were kind of few and far between, and it was just another game that they didn't look like winning and always looked like being on the end of a fairly heavy defeat. So, yeah, not much to shout about for Yokohama, but Tosu back to winning ways, back to playing very well.
Yeah, good stuff, good stuff. All right, so we'll move on to the two games that were played on Saturday next. Firstly, Cerezo Osaka 2, Fukuoka 2, and what a game this was. So many talking points from it, and some absolutely stunning goals, no question. Yeah, if you can, from a Tokyo perspective, I'll certainly ignore the 4-2 loss to Kawasaki, and I'll take this one as my game of the weekend. Absolutely brilliant, and talking points, as I say, throughout. Yuta Toyokawa had an early goal disallowed for offside for the second straight game. Then Masakazu Yoshioka drew a fine save from Kim Jin-hyun. That was all inside the first 10 minutes before Fukuoka defender Takaaki Shichi was shown a straight red card after a VAR review in the 14th minute. Sam, what did you think of the decision after Shichi went in on Hiroaki Okuno?
Yeah, I think this is as clear as you're going to get. I'm not really sure why the referee didn't see it live, to be honest, because, yeah, he's gone in, his foot, his studs are high, they go into Okuno's knee. I think it's a definite red card. And, yeah, it was unfortunate, I thought, for the game, because it started really well, and then it didn't quite get going again until the second half, where it was all action. And it was, yeah, harsh. No, it wasn't harsh on Avispa, actually. It was a clear red card, and I don't think Shichi can have any complaints.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was just going to say, Sam, that the zone highlights then skipped ahead to the 65th minute, just before 10-man Avispa went ahead through a brilliant Yoshioka strike. So it's fair to say that Cerezo didn't do much with their man advantage.
No, they did nothing, but Avispa have to have all the credit, because they're very good, compact, and they're well drilled by their manager, and they got into shape, and they just closed all the spaces off. They allowed them to go wide, but with Groly and Tatsuki Nara, they just cleared everything away very easily. And yeah, it was pretty incredible how comfortable Avispa were in that first half. And yeah, I have to give a lot of props to Hasebe, who changed things on the fly, and that team got them through that first half. And yeah, it was a really good defensive performance.
Yeah, and then they went ahead against the odds in the 67th minute, and what an absolutely superb goal it was from the previously mentioned Masakazu Yoshioka. A corner was kind of half-cleared to the edge of the box, and actually a heavy touch from Yoshioka, but I think that made his mind up for him. He decided he had to try a curler, and from just outside the box, goodness knows how far this ball started outside the frame of the goal, at least a yard, I reckon, and he's curled it in. The keeper, Kim Jin-hyun, had absolutely no chance, and an absolutely brilliant way to score your first J1 goal. Yoshioka giving 10-man Avispa the lead in the 67th minute, but Cerezo turned the game on its head, and that was due to a couple of substitutions made by their manager, Sam. So I guess they deserve credit for changing things up when it wasn't working, because Nakajima and Kato came on, and their brilliant goals, as I say, flipped the game on its head and gave Cerezo the lead.
They did, yeah, really good. I mean, Nakajima, a youngster that was just thrown in, really. I mean, he came on in the previous game in midweek, but last season he was with the J3 team. I think he was their best player last year, from what I can tell. But, yeah, he showed real quality here. I don't know if he's any relation to Shoya, but his left foot certainly seems to be, because it's an incredible effort. And this is one. There is absolutely no chance for Murakami. It's just inside the post. I mean, a really good goal. And equally good goal, actually, is the Kato one, because his movement in between, as I said before, Groly and Nara had defended very well with these crosses, but Kato just has this little clever bit of movement that gets in around Nara. The ball in from Marahashi is absolutely perfect, and Kato gets onto it, and yeah, credit to it. It wasn't Kulpi again. He wasn't there. He was still in quarantine after his COVID issues, but the coach there just obviously made that change, and maybe he's pushing for the actual job himself, because it really worked out well, and they got themselves in front and really should have seen it out from there.
Yes. Akio Kogiku. I don't know if he's he was on the blower to Levira Kulpi getting instructions, but yeah, the substitutions definitely paid off as Cerezo flipped the game on its head. Just a quick question without notice, Sam. Which goal did you prefer, Yoshioka's or Nakajima's? Nakajima's from slightly further out. I think Yoshioka's has got a bit more curl on it. For me, I probably actually plump for the Yoshioka one, even though I can appreciate the aesthetics of Nakajima's frozen rope. But which one did you prefer?
Okay, we're carrying on from our Patreon exclusive where we disagree with each other on everything. Yeah, I'm going with Nakajima, just because I thought everything about it was so pure, so, yeah, sweet. I thought, because as you mentioned, the Yoshioka one, he reacts to an error, so it's not quite as clean. The strike is lovely. It's a really good effort, but just that, as something as a left-footer, just the clean left-footer strike into the top corner, I just side with that. But both are very, very good goals. And Okano's, as we might come on to next, would have been even better. He's so unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a little bit rough around the edges, Sam. So, I'll go for Yoshioka's. Yeah, he's slightly poor touch, but, yeah, making up for it with an absolutely brilliant goal. And, yeah, as you mentioned, Kato's was terrific to put Cerezo in front, but there was a sting in the tail. And, yeah, 10-man Avispa came again. And in the 88th minute, the Spanish Nagasawa Wanma headed in a cross from Emil Salomonsson to equalise and make it to 2-2. There wasn't much pace on the ball in from the fullback, and Wanma had a lot to do from around the penalty spot, but yeah, he's powered home a header past Kim to equalise. Then in the fifth of 8 minutes of stoppage time, Masaaki Murakami has saved brilliantly from an Okuno header from 6 yards. Okuno, well, yeah, he'll be having nightmares about missing that chance for weeks to come, I'm sure. A ball in from Riku Matsuda. Okuno, yeah, his eyes must have lit up. He thought, I'm certain to score here from the edge of the 6-yard box. But, yeah, Murakami stuck up a hand and managed to deflect the ball over to finish what was one of the more eventful games of the season so far, I'd say, Sam. It's probably... you'd have to say on the balance of things that Fukuoka didn't deserve to lose, did they, after going down to 10 men so early? And so while Cerezo will feel frustrated to have lost the lead so late, at the end of the day, for us neutrals, a just result.
Yeah, really good game, and I agree completely. Avispa didn't deserve to lose that. The performance in the first half, I won't get highlighted, but it was really good. And to go toe to toe with Cerezo a little bit in that second half and get their goals. I mean, yeah, full credit to them. I have to say, well done to Wanma or the Spanish Nagasawa or even the Spanish Didier Drogba, as he was with this header. It was an unbelievable header with three players around him, no pace to work with, and for him to get that header in past Kim, it's full credit to him. It's a wonderful goal, the best thing by quite a margin that I've ever seen him do. And Murakami at the other end, who much maligned, but he has in the last few weeks has really come on. And Okuno should score, but it's a really good save from Murakami. So yeah, full credit to Avispa and Cerezo. Yeah, they'll feel a little bit hard done by, but I thought draw absolutely fair.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, there's a collector's item for your listeners. Yeah, Sam paying a compliment to the Spanish Nagasawa. So, make sure you bookmark that one. So the other game on Saturday produced one of the most surprising results of the weekend. And, well, I think we can probably say it was the most surprising result of the weekend. Shonan went away to Hiroshima and returned with all 3 points after a 1-0 win. This is a game of missed opportunities and, poor finishing from Sanfrecce, to be blunt. Their best chance of the first half came just 3 minutes before the break when Toshihiro Aoyama's 30-yarder was tipped over by Kosei Tani. But then 11 minutes into the second half, the visitors, Belmare, took the lead when Satoshi Tanaka won the ball 35 yards from goal, passed to Shuto Machino and continued his run, taking the return pass and finishing neatly past Keisuke Osako for his first J1 goal. And from there, Shonan saw things out relatively comfortably, Sam. It was really frustrating afternoon for Hiroshima, but that's not to take anything away from Shonan, a huge victory for them.
Yeah, really good victory for Shonan. I think they've played fairly well, actually, this season, without necessarily getting the victories that they would have liked. But, yeah, this was another good performance. Hiroshima should have won it. They had a lot of the ball. They had a lot of kind of good chances, or they got into good areas, but they just weren't clicking at all in the final third. I think, but they come into the game making a lot of changes. I think they saw it as a home game against Shonan and thought, this is the game that we can rest all our better players. I mean, Kawabe wasn't starting, Morishima wasn't, Junior Santos, Asano, yeah, all those that would be regulars, just, yeah, they weren't playing in this game, and the ones that came in didn't do themselves justice. They didn't push themselves into the first team, I don't think, because, yeah, just the finishing was just not there, and the final cross wasn't there, and I don't even think it was necessarily terrific defending from Shonan that stopped them. I just thought Sanfrecce were just not on it at all, but Shonan took advantage of that. They put in a moment of quality with their 1-2 and the finish from Tanaka. So, yeah, fair play to Shonan. A really important 3 points for them.
All right. And yeah, Shonan supporters listening are probably wishing we could spend a little bit more time on this game. But, I mean, that was pretty much that were the major talking points. So all we can do is, yeah, give credit to Shonan up to the heady heights of 12th. And, yes, move on to the next game. Well, I guess, yeah, that was probably the most surprising result of the weekend. But maybe finishing in the silver medal position was a Sendai 0, Yokohama F. Marinos 0. If you got a decent memory, listeners, and I must admit I had to look it up as to what year it was. 3 years ago, Yokohama won this exact same fixture 8-2 at the Yurtech Stadium. The last couple of years had been much tighter, though, and this game on Sunday carried on that more recent trend. Shots and possession, again, I don't really know who I can rely on these days, Sam, because the J-League website and Nikkan Sports are vastly different from what you get when you do a Google search for J1 scores. So it's fair to say that Yokohama F. Marinos outshot and vastly outpossessed Sendai, but they were unable to break down the Vegalta back line, despite numerous chances. And, again, good work in the Sendai goal from Jakub Slovic, as we've come to expect. So was this just an off day for F. Marinos, or a more stern defensive performance from Vegalta in front of their home support, or a combination of both?
Yeah, a combination of both, because Sendai set up very defensively. They very rarely got into the Yokohama half, from what I can remember. And, I mean, when they do, they haven't really got that any sort of clinical nature. So I don't think Sendai at any point looked like they were going to get anything a win from this game. But they sat down deep, and when you've got Maeda as your lone striker, you want a team to be a lot further up the pitch, because his main attribute is his pace. So when that is kind of nullified, as it was in this game, I think they ran out of ideas a little bit, Yokohama. They had moments where they were in decent positions. There was that one where it was Maeda right at the back post when Elbert fired it across goal, and he just needed to grow a little bit to reach it. But there weren't really any clear-cut chances where you'd say they had to score. I mean, Slovic made a very good save from an Amano free kick, but there wasn't a bit where Vegalta were completely caught out and Yokohama were in on goal and had chances. It was a kind of very half chances, if anything, for Marinos, who just needed to... they had Marcos Junior back off the bench, but they needed a little bit more in kind of quality, I thought. They just got to a point and then didn't really know what to do. I don't know. Yeah, it's just... they maybe were just frustrated by Sendai, but I think previous incarnations of this Yokohama team would have found ways to get through, but this team just kind of froze, I thought, in the final third. And yeah, credit to Sendai, because looking at that team on paper, looking at that defence on paper, I mean, there was no way I thought this was 0-0. I mean, I had it more likely that Yokohama would score 10 than score 0. So I have to give a lot of credit to Sendai for the way they just ground out this 0-0 draw. And yeah, really frustrated Marinos.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was expecting. An F. Marinos win, and yeah, goodness knows by how many goals. But yeah, Sendai doing it in front of their home support. Of course, they still haven't won at the Eurotech for goodness knows how many games it is now. But their home support could at least go home somewhat satisfied as a result of their team's defensive display. Although obviously they would have liked to see them do a little bit more in an attacking sense. Sam, just before we leave this game, F. Badinos made a triple substitution in the 63rd minute, but Ange Postecoglou waited until there were 7 minutes left before he introduced Marcos Junior. I presume that's just, you don't know the answer, I guess, but I presume it's just the fact that Marcos has not had much game time in recent times, and Ange probably thought that if he could just send Marcos on for a 10-minute burst at the end, he might prove the difference.
Yeah, I guess he was just hoping not to use him, because 2 weeks ago he was diagnosed with an injury that was take 3 weeks to recover from. So he's come back early, and I think he was just on the bench, if absolutely necessary, to try and get this something from this game. And he wouldn't have expected to have to use him, I don't think. I think he'd have thought the players on the pitch were good enough to beat this Sendai team, and they kind of let him down. So, yeah, they had to resort to Marcos, but really with 8 minutes to go, there wasn't much time for him to really impact the game. So, it's just they need to find a way to win games without Marcos Junior. I mean, he's quite clearly, I think, their best player and best creative force. And yeah, without him, they do look a weaker side in front of goal.
Indeed. All right. Well, yeah, we've got three games left to review, listeners. And next on the slate is the Ricardo Rodriguez derby. It took place on Sunday at the Saitama Stadium when Urawa, Rodriguez's new side, faced Tokushima, his former one. And Reds took all 3 points thanks to a Takahiro Sekine goal on the hour that gave them a 1-0 win over Vortis. The visitors did make the brighter start, though, didn't they, Sam? Masaki Watai's 25-yarder was tipped around the post by Shusaku Nishikawa in the 11th minute, and then 10 or so minutes before the break, Nishikawa made a point-blank save from Taisei Miyashiro. Just before the break, Yuki Muto's leaping header came back off the bar for Reds as they grew into the game towards the end of the first half. And then, indeed, in stoppage time, Naoto Kami Fukumoto saved from Takehiro Akimoto as the Reds finished the half the stronger. And then, yes, on the hour, a Reds short corner routine straight off the training ground. Ryosuke Yamanaka received the ball and then crossed into the box from deep on the left, and from the penalty spot, Sekine headed inside Kami Fukumoto's left-hand post. And from there, I don't know if Vortis's attempt to get back in the game, it just appeared to fizzle out, didn't it, Sam? It was slightly frustrating for their coach, but for Rodriguez, he could celebrate a 1-0 win against his former employers.
Yeah, I think that final half an hour, Urawa kind of played it out pretty well, pretty professionally, kept the ball, and Tokushima didn't really get going. They had their period for the first 30, 35 minutes of the game where they were on top, but they had to score and they didn't. And that's been their major issue this season, only scoring 9 in 9. Going into it, you kind of were worried more about their defence, I thought, coming into the season rather than their attack. But yeah, it's just a little bit more composure in front of goal was needed. They had a couple of chances. Nishikawa made a couple of very good saves to deny them in fairness. But just weren't quite clinical enough. And they had to take advantage of that period where Urawa hadn't quite got going. Because once they did and they got their couple of chances towards the end of the half, I think they were pretty much in control from then on.
Indeed. All right. So, well done to Reds. A very profitable week for them. Three straight wins, and it's actually saw them switch places with Vortis in the table. Reds are now up to ninth, but Vortis still a very creditable 10th after 9 games. And we've got a couple of questions we can touch on before we move off this game, Sam. Firstly, on Vortis and their fellow promoted side, Fukuoka. It's another one from Graham Freche, a relegation question. Who's here to stay, Vortis, Avispa, or both? On the evidence of the first 9 games, at least, Sam, they're both definitely in with a puncher's chance of staying up, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a good chance that both do stay up, because I mean, in my head, I've relegated Yokohama and Vigal to Sendai. It's still early, of course, but they just don't look very good. And so there are two options, I think, left to go down. Oita, I think, are a very poor team, so I'd have them as the third one. So they're in a battle, I'd say, with those two when Shonan and maybe Shimizu, maybe Sapporo. I can't see Kashima and Gamba still being down there, but I think I don't think they'll be quite comfortably clear of relegation, but I think they've put themselves into very good positions to be in with definitely a fighting chance of staying up, and I'd back at least one of them to go up. But I mean, I don't think I can split them at the moment because for different reasons, both have been quite impressive. I mean, what have you made of their starts to the season?
Yeah, much better than I'd expected. I gave the edge slightly to Tokushima in pre-season, but very, very happy with what I've seen from Avispa so far, and obviously, fantastic case in point of their fighting spirit on Saturday. So I think they won't be cut adrift. I think it looks like if Gumba buck up their ideas, then Vegalta and Yokohama FC will be cut adrift, and Oita, if they're not careful, will also begin to be looking at a big points gap. But Vortis and Avispa, great to see what they've done so far, and let's hope they can keep it going. The other question stemming out of this game is Reds related, and it came via Kurt on Patreon. He's asking about Kasper Juncker going to Urawa. That transfer is done, and apparently Juncker is in the country. Sam, Kurt says he's not aware, but has there been a big Scandinavian transfer in recent memory that has been successful? Well, if you ask a Fukuoka supporter, then the Emil Salomonsson transfer has been quite successful, although he didn't pull up too many trees in Hiroshima, of course, before moving down to Fukuoka, Sam. But it's not a market that Scandinavian players that J-League clubs tend to mine very frequently, is it?
Yeah, it's not really. I mean, back in the 90s, you would have had Michael Laudrup, who came over, and Freddie Ljungberg, but both like marquee signings at the end of their career. And I mean, I wasn't watching at the time, so I'm not really sure how well they played. I think, I don't know if you know or were watching at that point and could shed some light on those two. But the more recent ones, the only ones I can think of are Terigel Yanusi, who I thought would be a lot better than he has been. And it's been quite sad for me to watch him not do anything. And there was the other one was Robin Simovic, who came in. He was, when he was signed, he was the third top scorer in the Allsvenskan in Sweden. And he was a big, strong, tall striker, but really wasn't quite out, I don't think, at J1 level. I don't think he pulled up too many trees in J2 either. So the track record hasn't been very good. But this, at least on paper, Kasper Juncker looks like a really good signing. I think it's something like 25 in 27 he scored for Bodo Glimt last season as the Norwegian champions. He's a player, kind of a poacher, so you have to create chances for him, but he will take them. That's what he kind of based his game on last season. And hopefully, as long as Urawa can get the ball down, play as well as they are trying to get as many balls into the box to him, then hopefully he will take advantage of those. And he's just a kind of natural finisher. But if they are struggling, from what I've heard, there's not really, in terms of general play, he's not going to get involved too much. You're not going to see him dropping deep and setting up chances. So he really, really is reliant on the rest of the team around him playing well. So it's going to be very interesting to see if they can get the best out of him. But on paper, it looks a really exciting signing. And if they've spent, as reported, about $2 million on him, I mean, they're obviously expecting a lot from him.
All right. Well, it's a fascinating signing, and looking forward to seeing how it pans out for Reds, who, as we've said, have enjoyed a fruitful week, three straight wins to haul themselves up into the top half of the table. So looking forward to seeing what sort of an impact Juncker can have, and keeping Reds upwardly mobile. Okay, well, we've got two games left to review, Sam, and there were plenty of talking points and some lovely goals in the 2-2 on Saturday between Cerezo and Fukuoka. The other 2-2 draw from the match day came at the Sapporo Dome on Sunday. It was Sapporo 2, Kashima 2. A couple of decent goals in this one as well. But, another huge VAR talking point. And, we'll hold off on the jingle for just a second, and we'll build up the suspense for the listeners and talk about the first three goals, as Kashima obviously roared out of the gates and were 2-0 up inside 20 minutes through Katsuya Nagato and then ISA Wada. At that point of the game, Sam, Sapporo looked pretty hopeless. I mean, Kashima had capitalized on a couple of fortunate breaks in the case of the Nagato goal, with a Juan Alano shot deflecting off a defender and going to an unmarked Nagato, who blasted home. But then they were caught napping a little bit, weren't they, when an antlers corner was only half cleared. The ball was hoofed back into the box, and Koki Machida headed down while the Sapporo defenders were appealing for an offside that never was. Wada calmly stroked home to make it 2-0.
Yeah, they kind of cleared the box in stages and not really in a line at all. And just kind of left them in onside. Machida heads it down. No one's near Ueda, who finishes very well. But not very good defending from Sapporo, as we've probably come to expect, actually. But it was at that point, Kashima had absolutely dominated the game. They, as you said, got a little bit lucky with the first goal, but they were very worthy of their 2-0 lead at this point. And after they beat Kashima midweek and they were 2-0 up here, I was thinking, maybe this team has turned the corner, but then they went into reverse.
Well, yeah, 6 minutes later, Sapporo got a goal back when Shunta Tanaka stroked home a calm finish after the antlers defence couldn't clear an Akito Fukumori free kick. Nothing special about the free kick, it must be said, either. Just low into the box from Fukumori. I think it deflected off Chanatip, didn't it? And who didn't really know much about it. But Tanaka was the beneficiary, and a decent finish from him. And then we've got to do it, listeners. All right, the major talking point from this game, and one of the biggest ones of the entire weekend, it all kicked off in the 65th minute. It's time for This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. All right, Sam, Takuro Kaneko is fouled by Katsuya Nagato. The ref's given a penalty. What can you say? 5 minutes later, Anderson Lopez slots home the spot kick. But how on earth this has been allowed to stand is it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, everything is wrong with this. I mean, this is the worst decision from VAR so far this season by quite a distance. I mean, the foul is like, if it is, it's a very hot, soft foul at most, but the contact is outside the area. He's definitely, not touching him as he goes down in the area. Kaneko, when he gets into the area, just throws himself to the floor, and it takes forever. First of all, why is the referee called over to the monitor? Because it's just, is it in or out of the box? And surely the guy in the looking at it on the monitor can just tell him that it's in or out. But for whatever reason, we have to go through this rigmarole. He comes over. He's got the two replays side by side, where it's one where he's just behind to see when the contact stops, and the other one is on the line. It is so clear that it's not in the box, and I have no idea what he's seen to award this penalty. It's just an horrendous decision. I think it took over 4 minutes for them to get to this awful decision. It was just, it's the worst of VAR, and you can see why people get frustrated with it when this is the way it's been used. I mean, absolutely dreadful. I just can't see why it's been given.
Yeah, I mean, to call him stubborn, the referee is, it's one of the understatements of the year, isn't it? I mean, the fact that he's been called over means that his VAR has serious question marks about this decision. But, Mr. Hayato Shimizu is having none of it, is he? After, an extended look appeared to be, to anybody with a 2020 vision, or actually mine isn't 2020, but I can still see that, it's well and truly outside the box. But he's decided that, I don't know, he doesn't want to infuriate the 10,300 people inside the Sapporo Dome by reversing his decision and taking a penalty off the home team. It's impossible to fathom, isn't it? Because, there's no way a rational human being can look at that and see that it's not outside the box. It's just it's ridiculous. And obviously Anderson Lopez is a very grateful beneficiary of it. Easy for you to say, as he scored his eighth goal of the season and now leads the race for the Golden Boot. But I don't know, you almost should have an asterisk alongside, shouldn't it? His tally of 8 goals, because, that's just wrong. And, it's not like me to feel any sort of sympathy for Kashima Antlers, but, in this case, they've been well and truly stitched up. And, it's just, it's all wrong. And, listeners, that was This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. All right, so that made it 2-2. Anderson Lopez, yes, as I said, with his 8th goal of the season. It should be said 4 of those have come from the spot, and not all as gift-wrapped as this one was, but fair play to the Sapporo striker, top of the pops at the moment. And another question from Grum Freche concerned Anderson Lopez. Consadole, of course. Anderson Lopez started fast and great before in previous seasons. Will this be the year where he will finish the job and become the top goal scorer? I guess if he's awarded penalties every other week, every other match day, Sam, he's probably in with a decent shout. We know he's capable of the spectacular, and he's got the odd outburst in him here and there. But I don't know. Obviously, there are strikers of better quality across the league, but the likes of Everaldo certainly got to play catch-up at this stage, hasn't he? Everaldo's still on nil goal, and Anderson is up to 8. So, I don't know, I suppose he's in with a decent shout as things stand of finishing up at least in the top 3.
I mean, he's been put in a decent position, but, I mean, you said it there, the asterisk by him. 4 penalties. And this one was quite fortunate. The ones against Kobe as well, they both were contentious. So I don't know if he's carrying referees around in his pocket to get him a penalty when he needs it. And then, I mean, he scored 3 and 3. And the previous ones, the one against Avispa is where Tatsuki Nara heads it clear and it just hits Anderson Lopez and goes in, just with a looping header. The goal in midweek is just Suga fires it at him and it just hits him and goes in. So I don't know who he's paid off, but he's getting all the luck. I want his recommendation with lottery numbers, because everything is going his way. I'm not sure. I mean, he scored 8 goals, but I don't know how many of them are just through his individual quality. So I think he's been really fortunate. And I'd be amazed if he can continue this level of fortune going forward to be top goal scorer. I never really rated Anderson Lopez. I think occasionally he can have a really good game, but generally I think there are a lot better strikers out there in the league. So, I mean, I'd be absolutely amazed if he finished as top scorer this season.
No, fair enough. I was trying to be a bit more a bit more gracious, but no, you're right. You've broken it down forensically there, and I can completely see what you mean. So appreciate obviously the question, Graham Freche, but he's. I think if you go back through the goals, you can see that he has been a little bit fortunate so far. But may the good times continue for him. He's he won't be complaining. And when he's getting freebies like he did on Sunday, absolutely. No complaints whatsoever, I'm sure. So 2-2, it did finish, and that was mainly due to the homekeeper, Takanori Sugino, denying Ryotaro Araki in the last 5 minutes with a key save along the lines of the Gonda save in the Kobe Shimizu game to deny Yuta Golke. So that was a huge one from the Sapporo veteran between the sticks. And, what a game it was. So many talking points, but yes, obviously the VAR penalty award was the major one. All right, so the final game of the match day, and Well, it's very worrying times, isn't it, for Gunma Osaka, Sam? They're obviously in the very unusual situation of only having played four games so far, when some other teams have played as many as 10. But amazingly, their own duck continues. They're still on no goals this season after a 1-0 loss at Kashiwa Reysol in front of the amazing crowd number 5,555 rocked up to the Hitachi Dai. I'm not sure how they managed to get in that sort of sequence, but I for one absolutely love that. It was another really frustrating afternoon at the office for Gumba. They did have chances here, but again were unable to find their radar. Interestingly enough, Sam, Sunayasa Miyamoto started with his three Brazilian forwards, Patrick, Leandro Pereira, and Thiago Alves. Thiago's 30-yard blast in the 22nd minute was well saved by Kim. There was a change at halftime with Leandro Pereira going off and Takashi Osami coming on. But what did you make of the first half where Gumba, they threw the cavalry on and went with all three Brazilians from the start?
Yeah, I don't think it worked. I think you mentioned it last week that you wouldn't expect to see Patrick and Leandro Pereira start together up front. They're very similar in the way that they play the game, and it didn't really work. I think they were just going for absolute power, I think, and just trying to bulldoze their way through. And yeah, they didn't really link up very well together. The only real chance, as you mentioned, was that long range Thiago one, who, I mean, Thiago is a player with good quality, but he is very selfish, and you really will just shoot from 30, 35 yards when there are better options, and that's kind of what he did here. It was a decent save, but yeah, I think he should be doing something different, a little bit better, and they're not linking well at the moment. They've gone in all in on attack to try and get different players in. They've also got Wellington Silva coming in just to add to this, but at the moment, there's no real cohesion there at all, and this game, they were very disjointed, and a lot of attacks broke down, and Kashiwa were the team I thought that were more likely to score, especially first half, just with their sweeping counter-attacks. I thought once they got it, Osaka had one of his best games so far this season, in a season that Kashiwa haven't played very well, but he got on the ball, he was sweeping passes left and right, and Gamba just weren't being able to deal with them. So yeah, it was breaking down a lot for Gamba, and Kashiwa were a little bit more swift, but again, not a lot was connecting for them in the final third either. This was a really exciting game between two teams who were struggling for goals, but were desperate to try and change it. And it wasn't really that great in front of goal, but eventually Kashiwa were the team that broke through, but Gamba have still got a lot of work to do. And Miyamoto really has to try and figure out the way to go up front, because in the game since coming back from their COVID break, he's tried so many different variations in there. He hasn't got a clue, I don't think, what his best front four is, or front three. He's even changed that already. So, yeah, a lot of work for him to do, because at the moment, just not looking up to it in front of goal.
Yeah, really head-scratching time for Gumba and their supporters, no questions about that. You mentioned Osaka there. He was really prominent, at least in the highlights, and great to see him in his free-flowing best, creating chances, and testing Masaaki Higashiguchi himself with a fine strike from 25 yards early in the second half. Shortly after that, Usami, who, as I mentioned, came on at the start of the second half, shot into the side netting as the chances continued to come at both ends. Mateus Savio dragged a shot just wide, just past the hour. With 15 minutes left, Kengo Kitazume, his spectacular volley, drew a save from Higashiguchi. Gumba failed to clear the corner, and the veteran Kashiwa midfielder Hidekazu Otani, who was on as a sub in the 69th minute, fired home in off Higashiguchi's left-hand post, 7 minutes after coming on. With 7 minutes left, Usami mishit a volley from the edge of the box, but yeah, that just summed up another goalless display from Gumba in decent positions, but yeah, unable to hit the target really. And when they have done, they've found the opposition keeper in decent form. So it's Difficult times for Gumba. Four games played and just 2 points so far. Obviously, when we had Johnny on during the break, Sam, I kind of asked, during Gumba's break, rather, I asked kind of laughingly whether he felt that the league was gone, you know, even though they had so many games to make up. I mean, surely it has to be now. Even the most optimistic of Gumba supporters can't see their side, you know, catching even Nagoya in second at the moment. It just doesn't look a possibility at all, does it?
No, not at all. I think absolutely the title's gone, and they are facing a battle, even at this early stage, given they've still got another, 34 games to play. I can't see it, because psychologically, when you just spend time in the relegation zone, even though they shouldn't really be there because they've got four games or five games in hand, just the amount of time you spend in that position, you lose confidence pretty quickly, and it just looks, you look at the task that they seem to have to get even into third at the moment. They are 16 points adrift of Kobe. And obviously there are mitigating circumstances for that, but it's just mentally, it's just such a mountain for them to have to climb. I just really don't see them running the gauntlet and being able to come back. And these performances have not been good enough. And they're just going to get, I think, into a bit of a malaise at the moment if it doesn't turn around pretty quickly for them. And I'm not going to say here that Gamba are going to be in a relegation battle. I really don't think so. I think they've got enough quality to get out of that. But in terms of an ACL push, I think it's a massive mountain that they have to climb.
Well, yeah, of course, they had started the previous seasons slowly under Miyamoto anyway, but I mean, yeah, this is taking it another step further, obviously having four or five games in hand on teams above you, and let alone the teams that are battling it out at the top of the table. And yeah, relegation battle, yeah, I'm certainly not going to go there either, but Graham Freche in the final part of his five-part epic series of questions that's rivaling the Star Wars trilogy impact on the cultural scene part of his questions on Gumba is about whether it's a 2012 all over again, Sam. Whatever the problem is, will they figure it out, or is it their horrible relegation season, are they reliving that again? I think we're both in agreement that that's not the case, and even though they're going to have a particularly crowded fixture list, that they will work their way up the table. But you mentioned it yourself, the imminent arrival of Wellington Silva. For Graham Freche, he says he won't be the answer for their lack of scoring, as they already have three Brazilians. But yeah, I'm not sure how Miyamoto is going to work things with Wellington Silva coming in as well. You could say that he's got an embarrassment of riches, but he's going to need each and every one of them for the games that will be coming thick and fast for Gumba, obviously, with the ACL obviously to contend with. So I guess he adds another body and another a player to rotate in and out in forward positions at the very least.
Yeah, it's really difficult to, because I mean, he's coming in, he's not seen his teammates yet, and you're thrusting him into this position where Gamba are going to be playing every 3 or 4 days. He's got to try and get up to fitness first and foremost. He's got to get used to his teammates, and the rest of them haven't gelled together yet. So you see how much of a problem it is, and you're just throwing in an extra player into that. It's just going to complicate things, I believe. On paper, Wellington Silva is the best player that they have in those attacking positions. He's played for a lot of very good clubs. He was a pretty regular for Fluminense in Serie A in Brazil. I think if they had got him at the start of the season and he'd had a pre-season, I think he'd be a very good player and Gamba would be in a much better position for it. But it's just going to be so awkward for him when he might come in. Say he joins the squad just before the end of the month, and then might get up to fitness by mid-May, late May. And at that point, Gamba have played so many games, they've struggled for goals. I think it's so difficult, both for him and for the team, to kind of work that out and gel. So, yeah, I don't think it would be necessarily a slight on Wellington Silva if he doesn't just come in and pull up trees straight away. I just think it's a really awkward situation that Gamba find themselves in.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, well, thanks for that, Sam. And thanks, Graham Freche, for your fantastic questions in this week's episode. Indeed, thanks as well to Johnny, Kurt, and Khalil as well. Major contributions to this week's episode that we very much appreciate. To the week ahead, before we finish, listeners, on Wednesday this week, the ACL clubs have games moved forward from match days 18 and 19. Kawasaki and Nagoya are both home against Fukuoka and Hiroshima, respectively. Cerezo Osaka are also at home. They host Tokushima. And Gamba have the now daunting task of travelling to Tosu. That should be a fascinating game on Wednesday night. Match day 10 kicks off on Friday night with Sapporo hosting Yokohama F. Marinos. Then there are five games on Saturday, highlighted in inverted commas by the battle of the bottom, with the cellar dwellers Yokohama FC entertaining second from bottom Sendai. Yeah, watch through your fingers, I think, listeners. While Shonan hosting Kobe is arguably the most intriguing of the other games on Saturday. Then the ACL clubs are all at home in the four games on Sunday. The pick of them is definitely Nagoya welcoming Tosu to the Toyota Stadium. So, Sam, yeah, I don't think we're podding again for our patrons this midweek, are we? But you might have another one of your special write-ups on the way.
Yeah, they're really good games in midweek, so I'm going to do a roundup of those four games. It'll be available for Patreon subscribers on patreon.com/jtalkpod. If you want to catch up with those games, I will aim to get it out as quickly as possible that evening. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to these midweek games, actually. All four of them are quite intriguing on paper, so hopefully a lot of good action for me to talk about.
Yeah, most definitely. That that Gamba visit to Tosu, it's... Yes, you can't see it, listeners, but I'm scratching my chin. It's going to be it's going to be fascinating, I think, that one. And whether Gamba can break their duck against, well, obviously we've bigged up Nagoya and their amazingly tight defence at the start of the episode. Well, obviously Tosu are almost as good this year, having conceded just two goals from their nine games. So, yeah, whether Gamba can break their duck there. Of course, this is the J-League and anything is possible. Gamba will probably win 3-0 for all we know. But, yeah, we'll wait and see. And, yeah, as we've said, patrons can enjoy a write-up from Sam after those games are played on Wednesday. So, all right, mate. We'll leave it there. And again, terrific questions from our patrons to give us plenty to chew over this week. Great to speak with you, Sam. And look forward to reading you later on in the week and speaking to you again next week.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for fronting up after yesterday's result. I know it can't have been easy. And thank you to everyone for their questions on Patreon. Yeah, really good selection this week. So, yeah, can't wait to speak to you again next week.
All right, then. Well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank, once again, Johnny, Kurt, Khalil, and Graham Freche for their questions, as well as all of our patrons for their ongoing support of the podcasts. We'd also like to thank you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 10. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
This week in VAR.
This week in VAR.
The J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.